I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome and thanks for joining us. I just spoke with Jonathan Reynolds about his new book, Allegories of Time and Space, Japanese Identity in Photography and Architecture. This came out with the University of Hawaii Press in 2015, and it's a gorgeous book that really weaves together very organically text and images in a way that makes both of them really crucial for the argument that the book is producing. Now, what Jonathan does over the course of several chapters is he brings us into case studies, each of which focuses on a particular constellation of problems regarding tradition, identity, Japanese-ness, and some kind of visualization and some form of visualization of an object or objects or people or a place that is used as a way to document and work through these issues. So he brings us into some really fascinating photography, some photo books, some works of architecture. There's advertisements here. There are works of writing. There's a lot of different kinds of media that are brought to bear in an overall exploration of the ways that these scholars and writers and authors and artists are dealing with a kind of identity crisis and issues of Japanese-ness in the post-war period. Now, over the course of the interview, which is, I think, oddly appropriate for a book on architecture and building and built structures, you'll hear, I hope it's not too bad, but you'll hear some construction noise coming from whatever the builders are doing in the apartment right above me that happened in the course of our interview. So persevere through that. What Jonathan is saying is absolutely worth persevering for. I'm sorry for the little construction noise ambiance that has been created by this interview. And thank you so much for your patience with it. So I hope you enjoy the interview despite the hammering and the construction noise, and try to experience it as a kind of sonic, another kind of sonic text that is contributing to our overall conversation about home, built structures, environments, and experiences thereof. So with that, I will leave you to the interview and to my thanks and my gratitude for joining us again. Enjoy. I'm here today to talk with Jonathan Reynolds about his new book, Allegories of Time and Space. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Jonathan, and thanks very much for making time to speak with me today.
Well, thank you for inviting me to participate in your series.
Of course. It's not only a thoughtful book, but it's also a very beautiful book. And it's a book that is, I think, very careful in its use of photographs and text and in creating an experience for the reader that's really about an intimate move to and from these different media. And so I really, I loved the experience of reading it. I loved the book, and I'm really happy to talk with you about it today.
Well, thank you.
So along those lines, let's get started by talking a little bit about how you came to the field and then the project. So to start off with, how did you come to work on Japan and to focus on the art and architecture of Japan specifically?
Well, I mean, I had an awareness of Japan from a variety of different experiences as a child, but as an undergraduate, I hung out with the wrong crowd, and folks were really interested in East Asian stuff, and they, you know, come on in, the water's warm, and so I started taking classes, and I, in my senior year, switched from a major in sociology to a major in East Asian studies, and at that point, I was not doing very much art history. I did two classes on Japan, but that was about it. And my thesis was on the Allied occupation's policies towards Japanese labor union development, a little far removed. And it was only in graduate school that with an acceleration of my classes in art history that I switched over. And when I was looking at art history as a potential future. There too, you know, we always, if history is prequel or something. I had always had an interest in architecture, even as a kid checking out books on Wright and Breuer and whatnot. And somehow the two sets of interests in Japan and in architecture came together in graduate school. So a little on the late side.
So the book that we're talking about today opens up by introducing the embrace of Japan, or the embrace by Japan of modernization and its struggle with identity since the middle of the 19th century. And it focuses in particular on the identity crisis, as you call it early in the book, that really peaked during the Asia-Pacific War, the consequences of that in the post-war period. What you do in the book, and this is, again, I think we'll talk a lot about this. It's really quite beautifully done, is the book is focusing on photography and architecture as media for working out some key issues and working through some key issues, ideas of tradition, ideas of home and a longing for it. The use of photography and architecture as kinds of evidence, right, to support or to undermine claims about these issues, and so on and so forth. And we'll talk about the details at length in the hour to come. So can you talk a little bit about how you came to this particular project? Why the post-war period, and why these particular media as ways of working through these identity issues?
Well, my main focus up until this project had been modern Japanese architecture, and the starting point for this project was actually the chapter on Watanabe Yoshio's photographs of Issei Shrine and his collaboration with the architect Tange Kenzo. And that was my first baby step into the, at least in a professional capacity, as working on photography. And originally, this project was going to look very different. The Issei chapter was definitely going to be one of the foundations. I knew I was going to be doing something with the female urban nomad and urbanism in the 70s and 80s. But I thought I was going to be doing very different chapters, all on architecture. And working on Watanabe's wonderful photographs of Issei kind of seduced me. And when I was invited to participate in a multi-year conference in England a few years into all of this, I did a presentation on Hamaya Hiroshi's photographs of snow country. And somehow, while working on that, it just occurred to me that I was addressing some of the same overarching themes, but doing so in different media, and thought that it might be fun to shift the axis a little bit and make those themes the backbone to the book, and bring in more photography and let go some of the chapters that were going to be on architectural problems.
So according to what you're telling us in the introduction, and I find this very compelling and also very interesting as a historian who spends a lot of time thinking about sources and documentary evidence and different kinds of evidence, photo books were really important sources for this study. And you take us through several examples of them in different chapters. So maybe can you kind of bring us into the project, and we can lay a foundation for the chapters to come by talking a little bit about that, about the use of photographs, or not photographs, rather photo books for the kind of work you're doing.
Yeah. Well, several of the photographers who are discussed in the book would show their images in a variety of venues, some, you know, mainstream art-like galleries and so on. But many of them come out of a tradition of photojournalism and were publishing in photo magazines and the like from as early as the 1930s onward. Watanabe did so. Hamaya did so, Tomatsu, later generation, did so. Throughout this period, photo books played an especially important role. They had broader reach than small elite galleries somewhere in, you know, small alleys of Ginza would have had. And one could even argue that the special importance of photo books or circulating photographs in Japan is one of the distinctive characteristics of its market and systems of circulation. And these photo books are compelling for several reasons. For one, they often have a single author, even if there's collaboration with publishers and so on, and therefore often have a certain coherence, not necessarily thematic coherence, but a certain stylistic or motivational coherence to them. Really function in a variety of ways in the photo world in Japan. They certainly don't all look alike. A comparison with some of Tomasa Shome's rather gritty photo books of the 1960s look very different than Hamaya Hiroshi's Snow Country, but they each in their own way has a it represents a kind of coherent viewpoint or set of themes for each of the primary photographers in the books. So, in some cases I've been able to interview some of these photographers, but in lieu of that, having a document that has an unusually large role for the author photographer, where you aren't trying to filter out the role of a publisher or publicist and all the other people that are often producers of published images, allows me to make claims about motivations and so on that might not be possible in a collection put together by an editor with 30 photographers in it. Mm-hmm. So it's one of the reasons, at least, that I, on top of that, the individual photo books I've focused on are just extraordinary documents. So, call attention to themselves for that reason as well.
And one of the really fascinating things about these photo books, is that you're calling attention to the architecture of these books in a way mm-hmm. that's really resonant with the attention yeah. to and the attentiveness to the architecture of built structures. So there's also yeah. an architecture, right, in terms of the layout and the paradigms. And yeah. we'll talk about that and yeah. elements of that in the moments to come. But let's get to one of the works you've already mentioned, which is this collection of photographs about snow country. So this is something that's dealt with in the first chapter, which focuses on the photographer Hamaya Hiroshi. Now, he was the first Japanese photographer, as you tell us in this chapter, to join the international photo collective Magnum Photo. He's a very well-known and very, very important photographer, and he had an early career that was focused on depicting Tokyo street life. Now, you situate your discussion of these early photos of street life within a broader consideration of the relationship between photography and ethnography, and the exploration of photography as a kind of documentary medium for photographers in this period. So can you maybe start us off in encountering his work by talking a little bit about that? Photography is a mm-hmm. kind of documentary medium.
Yeah, the very earliest work that Hamaya participated in is quite familiar photojournalism. His editor would say, go out and take photographs of the dance halls and theaters of Asakusa. You know, and so he'd go out and he'd do a series of photographs of Asakusa and they'd print 8 or 10 of them. Some of his interest in focusing on these tight subjects, photo halls of Asakusa or flea markets or whatever, comes from an editor. But in Hamaya's particular case, he runs into ethnographers, both professional and amateur, at a critical stage in his life when he's sort of getting a little bit restless and looking for new ideas. And so the predisposition he has to look at street life or daily life gets reinforced, gains a kind of intellectual armature through his interaction with this world of minzokugaku, or study of the people, that was of significance in the late 1930s and 1940s, he's by no means the only photographer who will become very interested in that particular tradition or lineage, and use it as a way to be thinking about personal identity and cultural identity more broadly. One could call this a kind of self-ethnography, if you will. For at least Hamaya, sort of one of the originary thinkers is Yanagita Kunio, and several of the people he works with, at least initially in their careers, saw Yanagita as a mentor and model. And Yanagita has a rather interesting relationship to his subject. Historically, a lot of anthropology, ethnography, as it developed in Europe, was about other people. It was about it was made possible through a profound perceived distance between the observer and subjects, often in colonial settings. And Yanagita, while there is a city versus country or elite versus non-elite dimension to Yanagita's tradition, there is a self-conscious assertion that those people are us. And so Hamaya, through this thinking, is able to make the leap from being a city kid raised on the streets of Tokyo to being an observer of a quite, dramatically different a way of life in the countryside of northeastern Japan, but yet being capable of claiming that life, not as profoundly foreign and exotic, but as a sort of ur-Japanese-ness, as a discovery of self.
Now, in so these photographs that you're mentioning, just for listeners who haven't had a chance to read the chapter, these are part of a project he began in 1940 to photograph rituals that celebrated the Little New Year in the snow country of northern Japan. And these depictions are really striking and really quite beautiful. And this is, again, an opportunity for me to mention one of the things that I really love about the book, which is you're really giving us tons and tons of images that aren't just illustrations, but that are, you're sort of helping us learn to read these images, these photographs and other kinds of documentary image materials as ways of understanding what the text is arguing, and as texts that are themselves making arguments. And these images that Hamaya is producing are quite beautiful and are part of this larger story. So he's describing his project in terms that are resonant with what you've just mentioned as his return to Japan, right? He described this in terms of a return to Japan. This is a kind of nostalgia that's coming out of these photographs for what you described here as something like an authentic rural past. And all of these words for listeners are open to debate and conversation and interpretation, right? That he's not kind of, or the book is not taking for granted that there is something called an authentic rural past, right? That he's hooking up into. It's about the creation of these concepts as well as their use. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the really interesting things happening here, since we've already talked a bit about this really phenomenal collection of photographs, is you're bringing us into the importance of paratexts, right? So understanding how to encounter these photographs when they're published in like a book on, or when they're published in one format versus when they're published together in one of these photo books is to understand the ways that the architecture and the context of these photo books really can transform the meaning of these images. So can you talk a little bit about that? In this context, the importance of paratexts and the building or the built structure of the book of these photographs for how we understand what he was doing.
Well, I argue that this document, the Snow Country book by Hamaya, is participating in two very distinct genres. One is a kind of ethnography, and one is a fine art photography. And I think paratexts are a way of preparing the reader, shaping the reader's experience to read the core materials, whether they're text or images, in a particular fashion. And so when you look at the fact that this book was produced with the photogravure process, a high quality reproduction process, that it was in a, had a nice box dust cover. It had a rather elegant, understated title page. All of these elements, and the not suppression, but the sequestration of the text toward the back, most of the text towards the back of the book. Serve to highlight the images as art images. And yet, the caption at the beginning of the book, the nature of those texts, even as they appeared toward the end, most of them appeared toward the end of the book, would also signal that Hamaya did have this ethnographic project in mind, responding to The ideas of some of his newly acquired mentors in the amateur ethnography field. He did see these images as aesthetically shaped and as beautifully printed as they were, as being documents that would preserve for Japanese of future generations, a way of life that he and his colleagues were feared might disappear very quickly, kind of salvage ethnography. So I think those paratexts, that choice of beautiful crimson seal on the title, the presentation of the fine quality printing and so on, combined with these ethnographic signals, make the experience of the book do double duty.
Now, of course, context is also really important for the way you are presenting his work. And one of the important points you mentioned here is something I won't ask you to talk too much about, but I just want to mark for listeners that contextualizing this book within a broader context of wartime photography, both his own engagement with wartime photography and, you know, the kinds of images he's producing and the conversation about wartime photography is really important for understanding what's happening in the Snow Country book, in part for bringing our attention to what's not there, right? Mm-hmm. And that absence becomes a presence when we understand the book in this larger context.
Yeah. Now, I don't want to try and whitewash Hamaya's participation in the world of propaganda-oriented photography with very different paratexts, such as his contributions to the famous or notorious magazine Front. But it really is striking that given this other part of his career at exactly the same time, it is extraordinary that the war never seems to enter in at all. And I think that's a very self-conscious decision on his part and signals to us, at least to some extent, what the meaning of this world was for him personally, as well as professionally or broadly more socially.
So as we move to the next chapter, we move to another engagement with the problem of Japanese identity and Japanese-ness. And this is a chapter that looks at the work of Okamoto Taro. Now, he was known for his painting, sculpture, writing, and he had very kind of avant-garde practices that were related to his training, his experience, his interest in with what was going on in Europe. Now, he was interested in defining tradition, and I'm using my little scare quotes here. You can't see them, but hopefully you can hear them. Such that, as you put it in this chapter, it's eliminating the gap between modern Japan and its pre-modern past. And the nature of his engagement with that pre-modern past is very much a focus of what's happening here. So he writes an essay in 1952 about Jomon ceramics. So why don't we maybe enter into this part of the book and its arguments with a little exploration of what's going on here. What are Jomon ceramics? Why is he so fascinated with them? And what's important for us to know about them?
Okay. Well, the Jomon ceramics are ceramics that were produced in an archaeological horizon that the dates of which are constantly shifting beneath our feet. Probably most people right now would date Jomon to around 12,000 BCE to around 800-600 BCE. Traditionally, both of those dates were moved forward a little bit, but Yayoi, the subsequent archaeological period, has been moved back further, and there have been confirmed finds that are associated with Jomon that are older than we had originally thought. So, but all that said, artifacts of a culture that are as remote for Okamoto as any he could have found. And what I find interesting in Okamoto floating in surrealist circles in Paris in the late 1930s, has to leave Paris on the eve of the Nazis' entry into Paris, in part because he was worried that his associations with certain leftists might make his presence in Paris problematic. So he has, at least to some degree, left-leaning credentials. And as an intellectual trying to find his footing in the immediate post-war period, he does something very interesting. There's a passage in Lewis Mumford's The Brown Decades about each generation making war with its father's generation and embracing its grandfather's generation. And if you will, Jomon gave Okamoto the leverage to firmly break with the period of militarism from which Japan was just emerging and find a way to be Japanese and yet not participate in the cultural chauvinism and the the oppressive politics of the immediate, the immediately previous period. So he's not making alliances with his grandfather's generation. He's making alliances with his great grandfather's generation. I think it's a really very interesting strategy. And it moves him so far back in history that he can, especially given the archaeological evidence available at that time and even today, though there has been a lot of activity, a lot of archaeological activity since the 1950s, he could make of Jomon what he needed to make it. So while there had been a history for a number of generations of for instance, claiming the Jomon as the Ur-Japanese or making the Jomon the pure people prior to the Ur-Japanese, who were the subsequent Yayoi. You know, there are all these very complicated cultural politics around the embrace or rejection of these two major archaeological horizons, Jomon and Yayoi. He's able, for example, in a very interesting way, to assert that, no, the Yayoi isn't Ur-Japanese. It is a combination of the Jomon and Yayoi that make Japanese culture what it is, right? There's this, it's a way to, if you will, claim a kind of cultural diversity through kind of this navigation of these very early cultural traditions that allows him to work through his very contemporary 1950s politics through this kind of cultural engagement.
Now, one of the really interesting things that's happening in his work and in your discussion of his work is he's invoking dimensionality, right? Throughout this book, we have been and will be talking about time and space and the kind of dimensionality that way. He invokes a fourth dimension. So this essay he writes in 1952 is on Jomon ceramics, dialogue with the fourth dimension. Now, this fourth dimension of Jomon culture, as he describes it, is very intimately related to magic. And this becomes important in terms of how the chapter understand his work for many reasons. But one of those reasons is he's making a kind of analogy here between, or an allegory here, right, that relates contemporary artists to prehistoric hunter-gatherers. The way you describe it here, these hunter-gatherers courageously tackled some of the most vital problems of their society through magical intervention. So let's talk about magic. What's going on there?
Well, here too, I think you can find roots in his experiences of the 1930s. As most historians of Okamoto point out, he studied it, took classes along with his surrealist friends at the Sorbonne and other institutions in Paris, and studied under Marcel Mauss. And of course, Mauss is famous for his work on magic, was familiar with Eliade and with a number of other intellectuals active in that Parisian environment in the 30s through the 50s, and. The idea here is that that the role of magic in prehistoric societies was not gratuitous. Magic was a way to establish a spiritual relationship between the hunters and their prey. Mm-hmm. That this is the fundamental source of you know, of this, of food. This is the foundation of the culture. Otherwise, folks would starve. The role of shaman and others who participated in magic were playing an absolutely essential role. And there the analogy with the artist comes into play, that the contemporary artist is, in some sense, as gratuitous as the activity may seem to some, exploring the spiritual dimension of society at a time of tremendous crisis. He is living in the midst of the Cold War here. Right. And Japan is, of course, in a very precarious position in that relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union. Through their exploration of this other realm, call it magic or something else, art, artists are really playing a vital role in helping preserve culture. And even the survival of the species. So I think that's one of the allegories that Okamoto is playing with here. He will make explicit connections between that spiritual realm of the prehistoric Jomon people and the extraordinary ceramics, these wildly dynamic ceramics, particularly associated with Middle Jomon of northeastern Japan, this whole other realm of sort of spiritual travel and so on the part of the shaman, and then making a very interesting explicit comparison between these wildly, extravagantly decorated mid-Jomon vessels and the most contemporary avant-garde sculpture. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty wild claim. I mean, he's comparing these Jomon vessels with Giacometti and Gonzalez and other artists who were exact contemporaries of his. Right. So.
Right. And so that is a super fascinating case study, but that's not the only one. And that's not the last one. And it moves from that into, or the book moves from that into a chapter on an equally fascinating case study. And this is one that you've mentioned as really one of the seeds of the project as a whole. This is the study of photographs and a book of photographs on the Issei Shrine. So chapter 3 focuses on the Issei Shrine and brings us early on into the history of ways that the shrine has been imaged and has been understood prior to the 20th century and into the early 20th century. And it looks at a seminal publication that represented the collaborative work of several key artists and scholars, and one of them is this fascinating photographer, Watanabe Yoshio. Now, speaking of spiritual travel, which I think you just were talking about in the context of the work that we've been describing from Chapter 2, there's also a kind of spiritual travel that happens through the photography of Watanabe of the Issei Shrine. And you bring us into the work that he did for this book of photography that was published ultimately by MIT Press, Issei, Prototype of Japanese Architecture, and show us how the ways that he's imaging this shrine create a kind of pilgrimage experience for the reader, and then kind of bring the reader or the viewer into this sort of intimate spaces, these sacred spaces of the shrine that otherwise they wouldn't necessarily have access to. So let's talk about these photographs. What for you is particularly important and powerful about the experience of these photographs for readers and the production by the photographer?
Okay. Well, it's Watanabe's work is quite diverse. He early on in his career in the 1930s did some street photography of the type I was describing, contributed to some of those partially state-sponsored publications of the late 30s. And many of his photographs of architecture were of modernist milestones, designs by Horiguchi Stemmi and others. Mm-hmm. And you could argue that the photography is somehow a neutral medium for the documentation, the objective documentation of these photographic, these architectural monuments at Issei Shrine. And yet I argue that there are certain strategies that Watanabe himself engages in, and there are ways in which the context, the texts by Watanabe, by Tange and by Kawazoe, the architectural critic Kawazoe Noboru, further these images, not that anything can be a neutral representation of anything else, but further a particular reading of Issei through these photographs that do some important work. So on the one hand, you have these sort of parallel readings. You have the reader entering into this book, you know, wanting at some level to, from afar, experience this sacred site that has historically been closed off from viewers. Even to this day, you can't approach past an outer fence into the inner compound unless you're the emperor, and I don't know too many emperors myself. So it's a way to virtually approach this architecture, which is to some degree sheltered and sequestered, through the photographs. But at the same time, the photographs are presented to the viewer in such a fashion that they are reinforcing certain ideas about architecture not present in the book, contemporary architecture. Watanabe's two collaborators are Tange Kenzo, who at the time was at the height of his career as one of the most aggressive proponents of high modernist design, and Kawazoe Noboru, this important architectural journalist who for a period early in his career was publishing with the modernist architectural magazine Shinkenchiku. So you have both this fantasy that you are approaching the shrine as an ancient pilgrim through the photographs, and at the same time, through the photographs, experiencing the shrine as, in some sense, a modernist architectural document that not only gives you a new appreciation of those buildings, but reinforces certain arguments outside the book for the value of modernist architecture writ large. I mean, does that begin to do what you...
Absolutely. No, yeah. Absolutely. And I think similarly to the way that we were talking about absences being really meaningful in other kinds of works that we've discussed as well, here, what the book is not doing is really, really important as well. So you, in this early history of the Issei Shrine, what had happened, and you describe this, is it becomes a kind of a very, very powerful nationalist imperial symbol. And so the fact that the kind of reevaluation of the shrine or the redepiction as an example of modernist aesthetics is not doing that other work, right? Becomes really important. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I argue that just as Okamoto Taro was trying to get past the immediate the debacle of the war through his embrace of Jomon, that Watanabe, Tange, and Kawazoe were in a way able to reclaim their Japanese heritage without participating in the wartime jingoism, find a way to have a Japanese tradition that wasn't about recent militarism, but at the same time make these buildings that had once been very powerful political symbols. Issei Shrine became the kind of center point, the core of a version of Shinto that was heavily sponsored by the military government. And Watanabe's and Tange's vision of this Issei makes no mention of it. What it does is it makes it into a modernist document, which seems to be the antithesis of the parochial jingoist vision of Japanese-ness that had been so widely propagandized during the war. And in order to do that, as you've said, the war just gets set aside, and we see Issei as a pre-war non-military tradition, but also as modernism, the one of the targets of at least some of the nationalist rhetoric of the 30s and 40s.
Now, the war is very much not set aside, or at least the immediate consequences of the war, as we move to the next chapter. And this is a chapter that looks at the post-war photography of Tomatsu Shomei. Now, this is a chapter that focuses in particular on the photography that Tomatsu is producing from his travels in Okinawa. And the collection of photographs that he produces as a result of his first foray into an experience in Okinawa during the context of Allied occupation is extraordinarily powerful. And this is a book called Okinawa, Okinawa, Okinawa. Can you talk about the photos that are collected in this book? And for you, what's most important and fascinating about these photos and the work that they're doing?
Okay. Well, Tomatsu entered into this project with a very compelling political agenda. He was living in a Japan that was completely situated within the U.S. nuclear umbrella. He was working at a time when the United States was using Japan as a stop-off point, R&R location, and so on and so forth, even an arsenal for the conduct of their war in Vietnam. And the presence of a very unbenign presence of the United States was visible in base towns all over Japan. He goes to Okinawa because Okinawa had the highest concentration, to this very day, has the highest concentration of U.S. military bases anywhere in Japan. And so if he had been pursuing this theme of the very problematic presence of the United States in Japan, turning Japan almost into a kind of cultural colony of the United States and political colony of the United States, It takes him to Okinawa, and that sense of frustration and anger is there from the very beginning of the project, because as he arrives in Naha Airport, he sees on one of the bulletin boards these passport photographs, dozens of them. And he takes that. It appears in many of his collections of photographs of Okinawa, including this book. Mm-hmm. And he sort of sees them almost as mugshots. And he sort of sees, he has to get a special permission as a Japanese citizen to enter into Japanese national territory. I mean, the fact that Okinawa is Japanese national territory is a problematic history in and of itself, but nonetheless. And so from the very beginning, there is this anger. And so this anger is, I think, very articulately expressed through, first of all, a very, very gritty black and white photography that does not have the sort of elegance of something like the Snow Country photo book that has photographs bleeding right out to the edge, a very kind of bold, hard look. And these photographs themselves are images of prostitutes soliciting work from U.S. Soldiers wandering around the streets looking for sex, images of U.S. military hardware, including, I think, 11 separate photographs of B-52 bombers, which were especially notorious because they were sometimes armed with nuclear weapons, which the United States denied had ever entered Japanese soil. But we now know in retrospect that they had. So, all these various ways of using photographs as a way to document the impact of the U.S. presence in Japan. And so it's not just the content, it's these blurry, dark, gritty photographs that convey something of that emotional response to Okinawa's conditions under U.S. occupation.
So he's interested, as you just described, in the possible presence of nuclear weapons in Okinawa. He's also interested in race and the kind of racial dynamics of the American occupation. So there's a really, really interesting part of this chapter that looks in particular at his photos of Nakamoto Shoko and the sort of and understands through a reading of those photos how he's interested in and dealing with issues of race and trying to you know, convey that in these photographs. Now, you describe Okinawa as it emerges from this particular connection as a Benjaminian allegory, as a lost Arcadia left in ruins by American imperialism, but one that still held out the possibility of redemption. Now, this is one of many points throughout the book where Benjamin and his work becomes really important for the kind of argumentative work that the chapter is doing. So could you say just a little bit about that for you? Yeah. What's the importance of Benjamin here?
Well, you know, Benjamin discusses allegory in a number of places, including the Arcades Project, but perhaps the single most important text for his exploration of allegory is his examination of Baroque tragedy. And, you know, that whole tradition is informed with Christian faith, and the worse things get somehow one is still aware of the possibility of redemption, you know, in the most, you know, at the nadir of any given plot, there is somehow a possibility that things could be transformed. I used this image of Benjamin's description of ruin as both ruin as a memento mori about, you know, destruction and so on, but also as something that reminds us of the possibility of redemption, because Tomatsu is documenting this place that many people think of as a kind of tropical paradise, and yet in this tropical paradise, all Tomatsu sees are these roadways that are filled with recklessly driven jeeps driven by U.S. military, barbed wire fences, American weaponry, a constant threat of the impact of nuclear weapons and nuclear submarines that are pouring radioactive materials into the waters and poisoning the fish in the area. I mean, it's a sense of utter ruin, this paradise that is utter ruin, but a paradise that could return to a state of grace, if you will, through the removal of the U.S. military. No, go ahead.
Oh, and in fact, I was just going to mention, he actually goes back to Okinawa after the occupation leaves, and the depictions that he has in that later series of photographs, it's actually quite different, right?
Indeed. He moves back to Okinawa just as soon as the reversion occurs, as Okinawa's return to Japanese sovereignty, and first sets up in Naha, but then also later lives for a period of months in some of the southern islands, Miyako and other southern islands within the Okinawan chain. And nothing explains this transformation better for me than a comparison of the cover of the first book and the cover of his next Okinawa book, Taiyo no Enpitsu. Because you have a first cover that is a gritty black and white photograph of a missile, a U.S. missile being fired off of Japanese soil in Okinawa, with this lurid yellow title with a statement that rather than say that there are bases on Okinawa, you should probably say that Okinawa is a military base, right? Pretty grim representation of the state of Okinawa under U.S. occupation. So this next book that appears a couple of years after Reversion is a photograph of with much softer colors for the title, and with this photograph of a fisherman, an Okinawan fisherman, standing on a rock looking out over this beautiful turquoise sea. He's just quietly, quietly fishing. Bright color. Color is introduced into this volume, unlike the earlier volume. And that that image of the missile being fired versus the fisherman over the fishing over the turquoise seas, I think is a wonderful reflection of the transformation, that redemption, if you will. There's the allegorical idea, that redemption that was experienced through reversion, or at least partial redemption through reversion to the end of the U.S. occupation.
So as we move from chapter 4 to chapter 5, we move from Okinawa into a very, very different context, but one that is super, super fascinating. And this is the context of young female nomads of Tokyo, as the chapter is titled. Now, this chapter takes us into the consumer culture of the late 20th century and this figure of the young female nomad. The 1970s and 1980s, as you describe early in this chapter, seem to mark a shift away from the search for, as you put it, a coherent and distinctive cultural identity that we saw in the work of previous artists. And it seems to mark a shift away from a focus on a kind of singular home, right? Notion of home that's grounded in a specific site, notions of cultural practice that are focused on a particular site. But as we'll see over the course of our conversation about this chapter, there's actually something a little bit more complicated going on. Now, you demonstrate this by taking us into the work of a number of really fascinating artists, advertising, or people who are producing advertising, architects, and we won't have time to talk about all of them in detail, but I'll just mention, without necessarily talking in detail about it, one of the works that you bring us into is Abe Kobo's book, The Boxman, which is really fascinating. So we can talk about that a little bit later if we have time, but there is some really interesting attentiveness to literary products that are juxtaposed with the works that I'm going to ask you to talk at more length about. And one of these works is a series of advertising campaigns that were produced by a designer, Ishioka Eiko. Mm-hmm. Okay, so these are advertising campaigns that each focus on or feature images of broadly conceived kind of nomadic people in very, very, in regions or in areas that seem very, very different or very distant from Tokyo. Can you bring us into this project? And for you, what's most important for us to understand about this advertising, or these advertising campaigns, rather, for us to understand the larger work that these ads are doing in terms of the argument of the chapter?
Well, the campaign that I think you're referring to, she is involved in an incredible array of different kinds of advertising products, mm-hmm. from book covers to seaweed ads to other products. But she produced a whole series of posters for the large clothing chain Parco that was a part of the enormous Seibu Sesson empire, mm-hmm. Run by Tsutsumi Seiji and others. And she, like many advertising people before her, wanted to generate a fantasy that would resonate with their potential customers, who were primarily young single women, though the demographics for Parco, you know, go well into the 30s and 40s, an important component, a component that they really wanted to build on was young single women in their late teens through 20s. And, you know, one might have imagined an advertising campaign that featured young Japanese women engaged in one fashionable activity or another. But for this particular and actually Ishioka does do that as well, but for this particular campaign that is appearing through posters on trains, posters at the department stores, and so on, features everything from young Maasai women in East Africa to a photograph of René Russo, the model, in the deserts of California with Issey Miyake clothing, right? And each of them is themed in a way that alludes to this the seeming freedom, no horizons or infinite horizons, the exoticness of the locations, which is anything but what most young women living in Tokyo and other major urban areas in Japan would have been experiencing in their daily lives. I can't think of a more dramatic contrast than some of the landscapes that are featured in these ads, or peoplescapes that are featured in these ads from the daily life of these women. And yet, Ishioka is remarkably successful at, I mean, you know, given that these ads were perpetuated and the related themes were perpetuated in response to them, is remarkably successful at establishing a resonance between these images in, you know, the deserts of Northwest India or East Africa or California and the lives of these young Japanese women. And I think a fantasy is being generated through this and other means that these young women who lived by what many outsiders would perceive to be a very disciplined, button-down lives, long working hours, working in offices, commuting day in, day out, and imagining the freedom that that nomadic life seemed to promise. And there are even ways in which, you know, what is one could make the argument that these young women were encouraged to begin to think of their own lives, even as they were living them in Tokyo, as nomadic lives. You know, instead of traveling across the desert, they are floating in a sea of subway systems, and instead of scavenging for firewood, they're wandering through Parco and other Tokyo department stores, and so on and so forth. And so there's, it's not just a kind of resonance; it's a parallelism between this fantasy of nomadic life and life in the commercial world of Tokyo and other major Japanese cities.
And as a kind of shout out to other Silk Road Studies scholars or people interested in Silk Road Studies, this is very much part of a larger fantasy about Silk Road and the Silk Road as a concept. And so we've got these urban nomads, these women, and they're, you know, traveling around, they're buying stuff. Now, of course, they need a place to live. And so enter architect Ito Toyo, who creates these really fascinating structures called pao, from the kind of Chinese bao, that are kind of based on yurt sort of structures, sort of, but that are ostensibly could be ostensibly used as shelters for these wandering nomads. So can you tell us a little bit, as we kind of come to the conclusion of our story, let's maybe conclude with him. What for you is so important about what he's doing?
Well, in some sense, he's taking Ishioka Eiko's promise at its word, taking it literally. So he exhibits, Parco invited him to do an exhibition of furniture design at one of their, this is the same Parco, actually it was at Seibu, but the Parco system is very important to this entire phenomenon. But so he's invited to do an exhibition of furniture, and he comes in with furniture, but he's also coming in with the portable yurt-like structure to house the furniture. And this furniture, it does not look, I mean, I've seen some very elegant yurts around, but, you know, brushed chrome, stainless steel, diaphanous textiles covering them. These are the most elegant yurts anywhere you will find. And so he's imagining, asking these women to live in these portable structures as they migrate through various parts of the city in their cycle of daily life. And he has some wonderful passages in which he describes the lives of these young women. You know, they're instead of having a permanent home with all of the appliances that we would normally think of, you know, he describes the 7-Eleven as their refrigerator, and the gym as their anyway, all of the sort of elements of modern life for these young women as components of a kind of nomadic life, instead of, you know, living to have the freestanding two-bedroom house in the suburbs that they and certainly their parents dreamed of. And so these POW were his contribution to that fantasy. They would have these portable pieces of furniture and these portable structures as portable living arrangements as they sort of floated through their lives.
Now, this is actually, for me, living in Vancouver, and as you can probably hear from the construction noise all around, right, there's a kind of, there's an analogous experience that I think many of us may be able to relate to, or those of us who are living in the city, or in any city, but Vancouver is where I am, so in particular, where, you know, the rather than living in these houses where there's a, you know, place to exercise and a place to, you know, go swimming and a place to do something else. We're living in these high rises where, you know, there's a gym and there's the hot tub and pool room. And there's this sort of weird modern fantasy that's also being created by high rise living and, you know, basing yourself in these tiny, tiny, tiny little apartments, but having a daily life that is extended across in a kind of rhizomatic way, the spaces of the larger structure around you. Reading about this architect and these structures and this notion of the urban nomad that he's helping create and speak to, I think for me was really resonant with contemporary city life for some of us. And you know, like helps me, or at least has helped me really look at that in a different way. So thank you for that. So at the end of this chapter, there's a kind of, and into the afterword after, there's a sort of reversal that happens, right? It may have seemed, as it has perhaps seemed to others who have looked at these phenomena, like Ito Toyo's POW, his nomad restaurant, right? This sort of Silk Road-themed urban nomadic advertising campaign, Abe Kobo's work. It may seem that, as we mentioned earlier, notions of home have really dramatically changed, that the whole idea of territory and Japanese-ness and cultural groundedness that so many of the other artists and architects and photographers from previous chapters were holding on to no longer applies here. But in fact, as you show us at the end of the book, that's probably not so true. So can you maybe bring us home by talking a little bit about that?
Well, the nomad who is looking at these, or the young female urban nomad who's not a nomad, is looking at these images and imagining living on the Thar Desert in India, or, you know, living in East Africa, or living in Morocco, or whatever. But what is interesting is the language suggests that in going to these distant places, they were discovering themselves. You know, their sort of fundamental self, their home, their spiritual home, if you will. And so even if the territory, you know, I argue that even if the territory has expanded almost infinitely, you know, we aren't talking about the core Japanese islands and adjacent small islands. We're talking about a kind of global expansion of the roaming territory. In some sense, these young women looking for their sense of self and sense of home in the Moroccan desert are in some ways doing some of the same things that the Tokyo kid Hamaya Hiroshi was doing when he was going off to the very different world of the snow country in northeastern Japan. And so it's in some sense the theme of the nomad for me is the exception that proves the rule. You know, what seems to be the abandonment of this interest in you know, a settled home and stability is in fact just another strategy for achieving some of the same goals.
So now that we're at the conclusion of our conversation, but not, as you can hopefully not hear too much, but the conclusion of the building of Vancouver and its built structures. That's
well, I hope it's not its conclusion. I hope it has a little more time left.
Now, of course, there's a ton of material in the book that we haven't had a chance to get to. Right? It's an extraordinarily rich study. And of course, we can only talk about images and imagistic documents that the reader will find there to explore in the actual medium of the book itself. So there's a lot we haven't had a chance to talk about. Is there anything in particular, though, that you feel would be important to mention for listeners that we haven't gotten to?
Well, I think we've covered some of the major overarching themes. I would encourage viewers to look at the images themselves, because the one thing that's absent from a radio interview is that, you know, there are some spectacular images that, you know, I take no credit for that whatsoever. But, you know, just starting with the cover photo by Hamaya, this wonderfully ambiguous image of a ceremony with the swirling of torches during that series of festivals at the Little New Year, and going through this array of images from really quite elegant and pretty to gritty and hard and dark. You know, the images themselves are sort of lost in this context. I would encourage your listeners to spend more time looking at the images and less time listening to me.
So now that the book is out, and congratulations on a beautiful and really thoughtful book, what's next for you? What are you currently working on?
Well, I have a project right now. I've been interested in an architect named Shinai Seiji for many years. And the core of his career is the 1950s through his death in the early 1980s. And he's at the kind of in a liminal position. He is good friends with several modernists, including an architect I've written a bit about in the past, Mayakawa Kunio. He's covered by a lot of the major architectural journalists, including Kawazoe, the fellow I mentioned in the context of the Issei photographs. So he's fully recognized within modernist circles, but he violates an awful lot of the aesthetic rules of the modernist movement. And I'm very interested by the ways in which architects and critics attempt to negotiate kind of inconsistency or apparent inconsistencies or violations, aesthetic violations that are apparent in Shinai's work. And so, you know, I'm trying to think through, you know, different kind of reception, if you will, of Shinai, talking about ways in which different architectural and critical voices have shaped Shinai as a way to explore some of the underlying tensions within post-war Japanese architecture. And there too, you know, everybody should go Google Shirai, because his buildings are just so funky and wonderful, they're hard to even describe. So I'm just trying to account for that through this discussion of his critical reception.
Well, best of luck with that project. It
thank
sounds
you.
Great. And I will let you go and work on that. So thank you so much for making time. It's really been a pleasure. And again, congratulations on a beautiful book.
Well, thank you for your careful reading of the book and for your interest.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.